The clumsy attempt of the hard-pressed first line of the Persian fleet to put about led to indescribable confusion. Some were rammed by the rear ships of their own side. This ancient shipping was poor, unseaworthy stuff by any modern standards. The west wind was blowing, and many of the broken ships of Xerxes were now drifting away out of his sight to be wrecked on the coast beyond. Others were being towed towards Salamis by the Greeks. Others, less injured and still in fighting trim, were making for the beaches close beneath him that would bring them under the protection of his army. Scattered over the further sea, beyond the headlands, remote and vague, were ships in flight and Greek ships in pursuit. Slowly, incident by incident, the disaster had unfolded under his eyes. We can imagine something of the coming and going of messengers, the issuing of futile orders, the changes of plan throughout the day. In the morning, Xerxes had come out provided with tables to mark the most successful of his commanders for reward. In the gold of the sunset, he beheld the sea power of Persia utterly scattered, sunken, and destroyed, and the Greek fleet over against Salamis, unbroken and triumphant, ordering its ranks as if still incredulous of victory. The Persian army remained as if in indecision for some days close to the scene of this sea fight, and then began to retreat to Thessaly, where it was proposed to winter and resume the campaign. But Xerxes, like Darius I before him, had conceived a disgust for European campaigns. He was afraid of the destruction of the bridge of boats. With part of the army, he went on to the Hellespont, leaving the main force in Thessaly under a general, Mardonius. Of his own retreat, the historian relates, "Whithersoever they came on the march, and to whatever nation they seized the crops of that people and used them for provisions, and if they found no crops, then they took the grass which was growing up from the earth and stripped off the bark from the trees and plucked down the leaves and devoured them, alike of the cultivated trees and of those growing wild, and they left nothing behind them. Thus they did by reason of famine. Then plague, too, seized upon the army, and dysentery, which destroyed them by the way, and some of them also who were sick, the king left behind, laying charge upon the cities where at the time he chanced to be in his march, to take care of them and support them. Of these he left some in Thessaly, and some at Cyrus, in Paeonia, and some in Macedonia. When passing on from Thrace, they came to the passage, they crossed over the Hellespont in haste to Abydos by means of the ships, for they didn't find the floating bridges still stretched across, but broken up by a storm. While staying there for a time, they had distributed to them an allowance of food more abundant than they had had by the way, and from satisfying their hunger without restraint, and also from the changes of water, there died many of those in the army who had remained safe till then. The rest arrived with Xerxes at Sardis. 10th. The rest of the Persian army remained in Thessaly, under the command of Mardonius, and for a year he maintained an aggressive campaign against the Greeks. Finally, he was defeated and killed in a pitched battle at Plataea in 479 BC. And on the same day, the Persian fleet and a land army met with joint disaster under the shadow of Mount Mycale on the Asiatic mainland between Ephesus and Miletus. The Persian ships, being in fear of the Greeks, had been drawn up on shore and a wall built about them. But the Greeks disembarked and stormed this enclosure. They then sailed to the Hellespont to destroy what was left of the bridge of boats, so that later the Persian fugitives retreating from Plataea had to cross by shipping at the Bosphorus, and did so with difficulty. Encouraged by these disasters of the imperial power, says Herodotus, the Ionian cities of Asia began for a second time to revolt against the Persians. With this, the 9th book of the history of Herodotus comes to an end. He was born about 484 BC, so that at the time of the Battle of Plataea he was a child of 5 years old. Much of the substance of his story was gathered by him from actors in and eyewitnesses of the great events he relates. The war still dragged on for a long time. The Greeks supported a rebellion against Persian rule in Egypt and tried unsuccessfully to take Cyprus. It didn't end until about 449 BC. Then the Greek coasts of Asia Minor and the Greek cities in the Black Sea remained generally free, but Cyprus and Egypt continued under Persian rule. Herodotus, who'd been born a Persian subject in the Ionian city of Halicarnassus, was 35 years old by that time, and he must have taken an early opportunity after this peace of visiting Babylon and Persia. He probably went to Athens with his history ready to recite about 438 BC. The idea of a great union of Greece for aggression against Persia wasn't altogether strange to Herodotus. Some of his readers suspect him of writing to enforce it. It was certainly in the air at that time. He describes Aristagoras, the son-in-law of Histiaeus, as showing the Spartans a tablet of bronze on which was engraved a map of the whole earth with all the seas and rivers. He makes Aristagoras say, "These barbarians are not valiant in fight. You, on the other hand, have now attained to the utmost skill in war. They fight with bows and arrows and a short spear. They go into battle wearing trousers and having caps on their heads. You have perfected your weapons and discipline. They're easily to be conquered. Not all the other nations of the world have what they possess. Gold, silver, bronze, embroidered garments, beasts and slaves. All this you might have for yourselves, if you so desired." It was 100 years before these suggestions bore fruit. Xerxes was murdered in his palace about 465 BC, and thereafter Persia made no further attempts at conquest in Europe. We have no such knowledge of the things that were happening in the empire of the great king as we have of the occurrences in the little states of central Greece. Greece had suddenly begun to produce literature and put itself upon record as no other nation had ever done hitherto. After 479 BC, Plataea, the spirit seems to have gone out of the government of the Medes and Persians. The empire of the great king enters upon a period of decay. An Artaxerxes, a second Xerxes, a second Darius pass across the stage. There are rebellions in Egypt and Syria. The Medes rebel. A second Artaxerxes and a second Cyrus, his brother, fight for the throne. This history is even as the history of Babylonia, Assyria, and Egypt in the older times. Its autocracy, reverting to its normal state of palace crime, blood-stained magnificence, and moral squalor. But the last-named struggle produced a Greek masterpiece. For this second Cyrus collected an army of Greek mercenaries and marched into Babylonia, and was there killed at the moment of victory over Artaxerxes II. Thereupon the 10,000 Greeks, left with no one to employ them, made a retreat to the coast again in 401 BC. And this retreat was immortalized in a book, one of the first of personal war books, the Anabasis, by their leader, Xenophon. Murders, revolts, chastisements, disasters, cunning alliances, and base betrayals, and no Herodotus to record them. Such is the texture of Persian history. And Artaxerxes III, covered with blood, flourishes dimly for a time. Artaxerxes III is said to have been murdered by Bagoas, who places Arses, the youngest of the king's son, on the throne, only to slay him in turn when he seemed to be contemplating independent action. So it goes on. Athens, prospering for a time after the Persian repulse, was smitten by the plague in which Pericles, its greatest ruler, died, 428 BC. But as a noteworthy fact, amidst these confusions, the 10,000 of Xenophon were scattering now among the Greek cities, repeating from their own experience the declaration of Aristagoras that the Persian Empire was a rich confusion which it would be very easy for resolute men to conquer.